You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
This is episode 158 of Retired Racehorse Radio on the Horse Radio Network, part of Equine Network, brought to you by Kentucky Performance Products, Cashel Company, and My New Horse. Retired Racehorse Radio is your guide to the adoption, care, and training of the retired racehorse, brought to you in cooperation with the Retired Racehorse Project and New Vocations Racehorse Adoption Program.
On today's show, we are chatting with author Christina Keim on her new book, Unwanted: The Causes and Effects of America's Horse Population Crisis. We touch base with Erin McDonald from New Vocations to get her approach to telling the difference between a horse who is asking for help, aka maybe some naughty behaviors arising, versus a horse who is asking for more challenge in their work. Plus, we introduce you to our adoptable horse of the week who happens to have ran in the Preakness. Stay tuned.
And they're off on Retired Racehorse Radio, the podcast that is your guide to the adoption, care, and training of the retired racehorse.
This is Joy Orr in Detroit, Michigan.
And this is Kristen Kovach-Bentley in Jamestown, New York, and you are listening to Retired Racehorse Radio.
Kristen.
Joy.
It's hot.
It is really hot.
I feel like as like Midwesterners, I mean, I know you're technically bordering Midwest.
Yeah, we're like borderline. Yeah, it's fine.
I'm going to consider you a Midwesterner for now. You know, I know we talk about the weather a lot. I know it's cringy for anyone who isn't a Midwesterner, but listen, this is part of our culture. If you don't like it, I don't know how to help you, but it's what we do. it really has been like really, really hot. Like the horses, while I'm not riding myself, the horses do not want to be ridden. They do not want to be touched unless it is with a hose and a sponge.
Yeah, we've just been doing like light hacks for the most part.
Yes.
That's pretty much been it.
Astrid loves a shower. Like she's living her best retired life. She is fat off grass in a healthy way. Like it's a healthy fat. Her coat is super silky. Like she's doing great. She's loving life. And she just comes in, she gets fresh, she gets snacks, and she gets a shower. And she's like, this is what I was born for. This was my purpose.
Yeah, our guys, yeah, they only get like baths when they come down to the barn, but then they're like, This is nice. You know, like Jobber drinks him the hose because he's a little weirdo. Mm-hmm. Wes stands very patiently for my mother to polish him. So yeah, it's just been like light hack season. Remember like a month ago, I was like, it's just going to rain all summer. We're never going to ride. And now it's actually dry, but now it's too hot. So
yeah, I thought it was going to be a wet summer as well.
Yeah. Which is fine. Cause I think now we have like enough water stored up. Like it's still green here. I know some places are pretty crispy, but we're doing okay. So.
Well, and our hay season's actually been really good. We've had really nice hay come in, so I can't complain about that part. True. But while we're recording, I'm 30 weeks pregnant. By the time this airs, I will be 32 weeks pregnant. I don't love it.
Do you have air conditioning?
Yes.
Okay. So yeah, we don't. So like... On recording night, I have to shut all the windows because the house is pretty close to the road. So I'm sitting in here and I'm very sticky because I'm sitting in my little cell with all the windows closed. But it's fine. Yeah, well, because like in this region, you didn't used to need air conditioning. And now it's kind of like looking like it's going to maybe be a little hotter. So we got to figure that one out. I don't know. Joy, I have a weird question for you.
A mini unit group.
Oh, yeah. The mini split thing. Yes. Okay. Joy, I have a weird question for you because... Tonight we are speaking with Christina Keim, who wrote a book on the like horse overpopulation crisis. Mm-hmm. So then you and I both, you know, got advanced copies to read ahead of time, which was really cool. You know, so we go into the conversation with open minds, having read the book. But one thing that comes up in that book is like owners' life situations change or like an owner passes away. So weird question. Do you have a provision like in writing anywhere for... like what happens to Astrid?
Yes.
Should something happen to you and Zach?
Yes, I do. So she has two safe landing spaces. My preferred space is she actually goes back to Mareworthy no one knows if it's their first time listening, I'm on the Mareworthy board, Mareworthy Sanctuary. It is a aftercare nonprofit in, well, now Nicholasville, but Lexington area in Kentucky, but they only take mares. And she was kind of a beta in that program initially. She was one of the first ones to kind of foster through with Kyle's farm there. And she was, yeah, one of the beta horses to that program. So the plan is for her to go back there. Should they not have room and cannot help locate a safe space for her, she will actually retire at my mother's farm. You would think I would reverse that. I know my horse can be a lot for somebody. And my mom just had her 70th birthday. So Astrid still got some years on her. And I do trust that Mareworthy would find her a safe landing space. Her ideal career is to help wean baby horses. Mm. She would love to be just a pasture pal to a yearling, honestly.
Hmm.
So I would trust that Kyle would find her the right spot if anything were to happen to us financially or medically.
Absolutely. Now I want to leave all my geldings to Kyle too, because he's a good guy and he'll figure it out.
He would probably have ideas nonetheless.
Right. Yeah. He'd figure it out. Kyle, they're coming to you. No, I'm just kidding. No, I have mine going to a trusted friend in Virginia who does a lovely job taking care of horses. I need to probably put in a like an updated provision too to make sure that they go with a little bit of cash as well, just to help ease that landing a little bit. Yeah. Oh, yeah, there you go. So. But yeah. Yeah, I got to thinking about that as I was reading this book, and I was like, well, at least I know that like I have done my part to set them up, you know, and anything beyond that, obviously, you can't control because you won't be there. But you know, it makes you feel better anyway. So
yes,
but I know that was a fun conversation we had.
It was a fun conversation. I know we've talked insurance, but we have not talked about like wills for horses. So that might be an interesting topic. If listeners want that, like, please let us know if that would be interesting to you.
We could just make Eric talk about it because, you know, as a lawyer, he knew the language that needed to go into it. But of course, I sent you the clip, the little bit that he put in the first draft as a joke, right?
No.
Oh my God, I have to find it. It was really funny. I'm going to just do it off the top of my head. But he put this in and sent it to me and was like, all right, take a look at this. Like, here's a version of the will. And I read it and I rolled my eyes at him across the room because he wrote in, you know, when I die, strap my body to my good saddle horse and point him west, and wherever I fall is where I shall be buried. And he wrote that in. And I was like, all right, I know you're kidding, but also, like, if we're going to strap you to Shorty, how far do you think you're going to make it? Like, I hope you want to get buried by the barn door.
Meal he finds.
Right. You're going to make it, like, to the diesel tank outside the door, and then he'll be like, whoops, and you're going to fall. Like, I was like, good one, buddy. So he has since edited that, but that is the version he put in the first. So it's like, great. So, yeah. Yeah, if you're going to be with a lawyer, at least be with one with a sense of humor. So,
yeah. Well, I love that. Yeah, I think that could be a fun topic because we don't talk about it enough. Because I think no one really wants to. It can be an
uncomfortable conversation. Icky. Nobody wants to do that. But there's also like, yeah, I mean, there's nothing scarier than thinking about what might happen to your horses.
Yes.
Like, well, who's going to take care of them? Where are they?
And if anyone to go off topic of horses for a second, I know that is sacrilegious on this episode to do. But I'm going to talk through Swedish death cleaning. Have you heard of that, Kristen?
Ooh, no.
It's a lovely short read. Highly recommend it. But it is a practice in Sweden where you basically declutter, not because you know it would make you feel good or like help your house out, but it's so you don't leave loved ones who deal with all of your crap. It is actually putting the onus on somebody or thinking of somebody else and the time and energy that you are expecting of them to go through the possessions that actually might not have as much value as sometimes we like to think they have. So in some ways, thinking about your horses in that same way of how would I care for them? Or, you know, I'm having twins, for instance. While I'm not planning to get rid of my horse anytime soon, she is stuck with me, whether she likes it or not. I am thinking about, you know, is our barn situation the best one right now? Or is there a more of a retirement farm or, you know, local family friend I could reach out to for her just to comfortably retire? So that opens us up to a really good space. So just kind of constantly thinking of the evolution of what's going to keep her safe and happy, but also protects like our family as we're evolving too.
Hmm. Okay, I just Googled this and I love this as a concept. I feel like you and I are like the anti-horse girls.
But it's actually like really beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it makes so much sense. Like, I would hate to be like, here's all my crap for someone else to deal with. But yeah, I do think like you and I are the anti-horse girls in that way. Like, we are not like, oh my God, go out and buy the matching saddle pad. Like, that has just never been our vibe.
Yeah.
Like, we're like, nah, declutter that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you know? I do have too many saddle pads. But honestly, it's because I'd like to dress my horse up like a Barbie, but I don't have all the matching outfits with her.
Yeah.
I don't. I'm right. More minimalist there.
I love it. Is it a book? Like, is there like a book I should be reading?
There is. And it's very affordable. So, and if you don't want to read it, just Google it. You can get the main concepts too. And it's an awesome book on Spotify.
It's a very bookish episode we're doing today because our main guest, of course, I mentioned earlier, is Christina Keim with this book that we got to read. And yeah, we're going literary today, folks. So if you need a end of summer read, this is the episode. Swedish death cleaning and America's horse population crisis.
Perfect if you're also sweating with us and riding is only 15 minutes for you this time of year. But we won't harp on it. We'll let you listen to all of the good things we talk about. Plus, I'm very excited about our adoptable horse who ran in the Preakness.
I kind of want him.
He is very much up your alley. He fits into your group very well. At least I'm assuming based on his pictures, but he's super cute. Before we get into all that, we're going to hear from our premier sponsor, Kentucky Performance Products. Has your horse been diagnosed with a neurological or muscular disorder? Is he showing signs of muscle wasting and impaired balance or coordination? Studies show that supplemented water-soluble natural vitamin E can reach a horse's brain and spinal cord through the blood-brain barrier, where it can benefit horses with neurological issues. If your horse has any of these problems, Elevate WS, a natural vitamin liquid, can help. A research-proven, powerful antioxidant, Elevate maintains healthy muscle, nerve, and immune function. It does this by delivering a highly bioavailable source of natural vitamin E that is preferentially absorbed and retained in a horse's tissue. For more information, visit kppusa.com or call 859-873-2974.
Well, Joy, I'm really excited to have with us today Christina Keim, who wrote the book Unwanted, The Causes and Effects of America's Horse Population Crisis, which, of course, when you just read the title, you're like, oh, this is a big topic and maybe a heavy topic. But it's definitely something, you know, that in Thoroughbred Aftercare is always at kind of the front of our minds because that's a big part of what we're doing. And that's one of the reasons we have this show. So we're excited to kind of deep dive into this book and this subject with Christina. So, Christina, welcome to Retired Racehorse Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, this is a big topic that you set out to tackle in this book. And, you know, I think emotions can get pretty high with this too. You know, trying to like take a balanced approach to this, because I think we can swing really far, you know, on the pendulum one way or another. You know, when you talk about a horse population crisis, and a lot of this book was dealing with the ways that horses are still shipping to slaughter out of the country, you know, and of course emotions get high with that too. So yeah, what inspired you to like tackle this topic, you know, with such a clear head?
Yeah, it is a big topic. It's a weighty topic. And what's sort of funny was this kind of initially started as I thought it was going to be an essay. I didn't think it was going to be a book. I thought it was going to be an essay about why I personally, as an equine pro, did not feel that resuming domestic equine slaughter was an appropriate way to handle horses that didn't have other alternatives. That was what I thought. I thought it was going to be like an op-ed style essay. But as I started to try to dive into the literature and the research and the facts about that, I pretty quickly realized that there wasn't really one good clear place to go for that information, right? As you said, it's an emotional topic. It gets down to your values and your beliefs about the horse. And I thought to myself, you know, if I, as an experienced equine professional, as a journalist, can't find the answers I'm looking for, what hope does the average horse lover have? And that's where I started it.
Yeah. Well, so I was like, well, man, like one essay. Yeah. Like that. First of all, this really got away from you, but also like, yeah, that's a lot to to try to tackle. So yeah, one of my past jobs, I was managing editor at horsenation.com, which is in the Nation Media family. And we covered some sort of slaughter related topics the best that we could, you know, like, especially I was working there at the time when they, I don't want to say closed, you know, as you pointed out in the book, the slaughter facilities aren't technically closed in the US, but I think the funding for the inspectors is no longer being funded. So effectively they're shuttered because they don't have the inspectors to keep them going. You know, and trying to do that in a balanced way and then reach readers, you know, readers were very quick to either come down on one side or the other and then call us out for not being on their side. So it is really hard to objectively find the facts on this anywhere.
Right. Absolutely. And I wanted readers to understand I was on a journey. I was on a personal journey to better mm-hmm. understand this topic and to better understand my own almost like visceral opposition to the idea of resuming domestic slaughter. And the secondary question to that, you know, I want to be clear, like this really is not a book about slaughter, right? It's a part of the book, but I really wanted to say, you know, okay, if not slaughter, then what? Then what? What do we need to do differently so that we don't end up with these horses that don't have a place to go, right? That was really the question that was kind of underscoring it, because whether you like slaughter, well, who likes slaughter, but you know, whether you think that's a viable option or not, you know, I think that many of us would prefer there just to be a better option. Right. And so if not slaughter, then what? And that really was one of the questions that kept driving me forward.
Right. Well, and you know, like you said, with this lack of information, you know, that just like what's out in the world for people to understand. And that was a part of the book that I kind of highlighted for myself, you know, was like even the organizations, like the nonprofit organizations and the, you know, sort of coalitions and councils, like none of us know, nobody knows how many horses there are in the US. Right. And there's no good way, you know, you can't just run around and census, you know, old school, like knock on doors, be like, excuse me, how many horses do you have? You know, like, so we're never going to know. We'll never know how many horses are in the US.
Right. Well, and of course, you know, I kind of tackled this in the book. The American Horse Council has its number. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's number is considerably lower because the only animals they count, and I'm using air quotes here, are those that are actively involved in a breeding program. So all those therapeutic horses, all those racehorses that are still on the track, all those recreational riding horses, the geldings, they are not part of that data, the U.S. Department of Ag. So you know right away that those numbers are flawed, right, in terms of an actual population.
And even like we've recently come out of strategic planning at my day job at Retired Racehorse Project and, you know, a lot of talks with Jockey Club and like looking at how the Jockey Club is getting to its numbers and its numbers don't match American Horse Council's. And we had some questions about how AHC kind of got to its number because they had at some point like a breed breakdown and we're not really sure how they landed on the number of thoroughbreds in the country. So that's also kind of like confusing a little bit of the work that we do. But we're fighting a lot of the same battles of data where like we don't know how many thoroughbreds are retiring from racing every year. So we don't really know the population that we are trying to serve.
Sure.
Which seems like the like number one, like the square one, like to start at of like, okay, how many horses are we trying to help? Well, nobody knows.
Right. Absolutely. Because as we know, every single one of those animals requires a certain quantity of resources. And absolutely, if you don't know how many stalls you need or how many paddock spaces you need, that is a fundamental challenge to the work.
Now, if you could wave a magic wand and get that number, like how do you think that could change this, you know, unwanted horse crisis?
Realistically, I think, you know, there are several numbers that I would say are a little squishy that do make it a little challenging. So the first, as you say, is how many animals are truly in need of intervention services. So we're not just talking about horses that are being sold from one home to another. We're talking about the ones that truly are for whatever reason not able to stay in the situation they're in, and there are not any other viable alternatives for them. So we need to know that number. At the same time, we really an American Horse Council and United Coalition Horse Coalition, like they've been working hard to figure out our custodial organizations, our equine rescues, our sanctuaries, our retraining programs, all these different types of entities that have the capacity to provide shelter, to physically take custody of these horses. You know, we have a working guesstimate of what that capacity looks like. And, you know, if you look at just the data that we do have based on surveys, you know, voluntary surveys and responses, it looks like, at least on paper, that those organizations are not full, like they would have space to take in more animals. But then when you talk to the actual people doing the work, the people who are in the barn aisles, holding the lead ropes, cleaning the stalls, all of that, they will tell you straight up, they may have physical space, but they either don't have the financial resources or the human resources to support caring for more. So most of these groups already feel like they're kind of at capacity. So you know, at some point you do end up in a situation where if we know how many animals need custodial care and we have a pretty good sense of how many spaces are available in the custodial organizations, the difference there is really this population that is very much at risk of falling through the cracks, right? That just don't have a place to go.
And yeah, for like, it's interesting to be looking at this, you know, in terms of custodial organizations, right? Because there's people that will go and like the place where my mom used to board her horse, the lady was a very cool horsewoman. And, you know, I'd go visit for Christmas and she'd be like, oh, I went to New Holland and I bought something that looked kind of sad and I'm going to fix it up and I'll right. get it going good on the trail. And so you have that population of like just private people also kind of doing their bit, and they're not a nonprofit and they might have different capacities as well. So getting a handle on those, I imagine, also just complicates things as well.
I think it does. I think places like that, I almost would look at that as like a bonus. I wouldn't count on that because, right. you know, as we all know, our industry is so tied to the economy. And so when things are going well, people have horses. And when things are tough or the economy contracts a little bit, it really is the most dedicated of equestrians who make the sacrifices they need to maintain the animals they have. Whereas someone who's a little more superficial or casual, you know, I don't even want to say it like that. That kind of comes across as insulting. You know, I think there's just a reality that sometimes, you know, the expense of a horse is just not possible to maintain. And so a private owner who's doing her one horse, two horse random rescue, you know, we admire those people, we honor those people, they play an important role in the process, but I would hate to be counting on that to solve this problem, if that makes sense, you know?
Yeah, no, it does. Yeah, when you look at it from a numbers and, you know, reliability. Right. Now, of course, then there's the challenge of charitable funding, but I want to circle back on that a little bit later. Because kind of as a counterpoint, like, I don't know if you are familiar with our banner event at the Retired Racehorse Project, the Thoroughbred Makeover.
Sure.
Yeah, it's the annual retraining competition for horses in their first year of racing. And we're fairly uniquely positioned as the RRP to gather what I think is a fairly significant amount of data on these horses that no other organization is doing. So we know, we poll all the trainers who register horses. They have to register them a couple months out in advance so that we can get a handle on the population and like, how many starts did they have? What tracks did they retire from? You know, what was their average amount of earnings? Did they retire with an injury or did they retire sound? And what you might find interesting is that less than 20% of the horses that go to the Thoroughbred Makeover come through a nonprofit organization. Mm. So 80% of them are still moving from racing directly to that makeover trainer through the direct market. So either through a listing agent, through a reseller who's purchasing the horse, you know, maybe putting some trial rides on it, getting it, you know, kind of let down and selling it on, or they're getting it through in-house aftercare programs. So, you know, I think we tend to emphasize nonprofits, but it's a fifth of those horses. Now that's a fairly specific population, but that's still, you know, anywhere from 300 to 400 horses a year. Only 20% are going through a nonprofit. So I'm not really sure what that says necessarily. I don't know if you have a take on that, you know, based on the research that you've done and the way that you're looking at it from your position.
Well, I think there has been, I do think there has been a bit of a mindset shift that started. And I really hold up Thoroughbred Aftercare and the work that's happened in that space as a model that other facets of our industry should take a note from. Because, I mean, I grew up in upstate New York, right outside of Saratoga. I spent a lot of time at that track as a kid. I absolutely was a diehard racing fan. But I absolutely also know that the mentality, you know, in the 80s when I was a kid is that those horses, a lot of them were throwaways, right? Maybe not all the ones at Saratoga. Those are some nice horses. But at some point, like when those horses were done racing, there wasn't a lot of concern about what happened next. And that mindset has really, really changed. So I'm heartened to hear what you're saying, that people are making direct connections. But I think it comes with this mindset shift. These horses have value beyond the track. These horses have value as an athlete that people are going to want. And so we have connections related to the horse on the track side who are knowing, okay, this horse is not working out. This horse is ready to transition into their next phase. And then we have people who are looking for those horses who say, I have the skills, I have the toolbox to take this horse who knows one job and teach him his next job. And they're trying to find each other, you know? So whether they're doing it through, you know, an amazing program like New Vocations, or whether they're doing it directly trainer to, you know, owner, trainer to purchaser. I'm just thrilled to hear that that's the mindset, right? Like these horses have value. Let's get them into the place where they're going to be able to make that next step.
I love that you mentioned too, like you see the thoroughbred industry is a bit of a model in that space, at least from the aftercare standpoint, right? Like, because I think it does touch on a lot of the themes that you have throughout the book, which is really that like value shift of how we see horses. And, you know, the industries I start to think of that could benefit in similar places are, I think, standardbred industries trying to get up there. We also know that there's a lot of people who get young horses who might not be experienced with young horses. They get overwhelmed and then they get kind of shuffled down the line with behavioral problems or whether it's economics, they don't do proper vettings and find out something was going on down their line and send it off as a behavioral problem. Like we see it all the time. I think there's a level of, you know, education and visibility that the thoroughbred industry has presented through groups like RRP, through New Vocations. Like, you know, a lot of these trainers have built businesses around these retraining and rehoming horses, I'll say, and not necessarily as a adoption every time. Sometimes it's that resell, but I think there's value of it's not like a one direction way to do it. Would you say that's accurate to kind of some of the themes you're trying to pull from the book?
I do. I think that's a great way of looking at it. And I think in other parts of our industry, I'm an English rider, you know, my background's always been more in hunter jumper, eventing, dressage, that realm. You know, I think even just in the arc of a horse's career in one of those sports, there can be a time where they need to change their job, they need to change their niche. And sometimes, like, let's be honest, we keep a horse going too long at a level that's not right for them anymore. Or we spend time trying to take a horse who was purpose bred for one ring and we're trying to make them do a job that for whatever reason that horse just is not suited for, whether it's temperament or whether it's just their emotional mental makeup. And sometimes we spend too much time there instead of kind of taking that half halt and saying, you know, this horse might be better suited for this niche, or this horse might be ready to step down a level. And that may mean this horse doesn't stay with me, but let me help him find that next place where he can have a loving home and be cared for and stay sound, stay healthy longer, right? And have a home where he has a job to do. And I think that's another part of the mindset shift that we see with the thoroughbred racehorse industry. And I think we're seeing it in the standardbreds too. Let's not race just one more race with this horse that's clearly showing no desire to get to the front of the field, right? Let's not do that. Let's make that transition and find that horse a new home and open up a stall in our training program for a horse that might be more suited.
I love that. And yes, I think there's definitely that starting to think about the second, third, fourth career of like, what is this horse actually going to do? Because it does add value to the story. And granted, we know the racing industry, like there is a science to the breeding that happens. I think there can be a perception if you're not in the world that it's all like very willy-nilly, get as many horses and hope someone wins. But I actually would argue that in the racing world, whether it's standardbreds or thoroughbreds, there is a lot more science and thought of how do you invest for those winners? And then even having a sport horse after who can still give good word to your breeding program, your trainers, et cetera, et cetera. So like you said, that model is kind of getting shaped in this space. What I'm curious too is it almost sounds like there's a theme that isn't necessarily mentioned in the book, or maybe I missed it if it is, but like a rider ego, right? Like, I feel like you're speaking very highly from the trainer perspective. I work with a lot of amateurs and wondering like if they want to rehome a horse or sell it, are they reasonably setting that horse up for success or do they have their own ego in the back of their head, which we know can lead to some interesting pathways for horses down the road too. Or they romanticize a relationship with a horse that isn't actually the best relationship for them, but maybe for somebody else, or romanticize breeding. I think we see that a lot in social media. You know, they fall in love with a mare, fall in love with a stallion, and you have people who aren't necessarily super knowledgeable in breeding and didn't do their research, breeding horses and getting very overwhelmed. So I think there's a lot of great places, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be in the racing world, but even speaking to sport horse models of those bigger bloodstock farms could benefit people into just widening their knowledge based on what I'm picking up from what your book had. Those are some of my takeaways anyway.
Yeah, I love that. I love that you're hearing those things. I think it takes every single one of us, you know, whatever hat we wear in the equestrian world, whether we're a rider, whether we're a horse lover, but not a horse owner, whether we're someone with professional experience, training, coaching, whatever, you know, I think it has to be this universal mindset that our priority always has to be from start to finish, that whatever we're breeding that horse for, whatever the job is, right? We have a job in mind. We're doing the most mindful matches we possibly can, trying to avoid the genetic pitfalls that we know are available. We have a lot of great testing out there for a lot of breeds that we need to be utilizing so that we can reduce the incidence of certain genetic issues, right? That then will set that horse up for a lifetime of challenge and make him less desirable for the average owner, right? You know, we have pretty good data that something like 80% of people who ride horses in the US consider themselves recreational riders. That doesn't mean they don't go to an occasional horse show, but for the most part, they're riding 100% for pleasure and for fun and not out hitting a show circuit and not out, you know, just burning the midnight oil or pushing to the limits, right? They just want to have a safe, sensible, sound horse that they can enjoy the company of. And so we really need to think about that as we create the horse, as we give that horse his foundation training, as we take him through the different phases of his life, you know, a horse that has a good temperament, that's had a good foundation, that has decent health is always going to have a better chance of finding a home than the ones that are quirky, the ones that have a genetic disease, the ones that are unsound. I mean, they just are. They're just going to have a better chance of things. So horses can have bad luck and they can end up in unfortunate circumstances despite our best efforts. But we really need to be mindful about how and where and who are interacting with these horses at all stages of their life cycle, regardless of what their job is going to be.
Yeah, I think like the flip side of you know, like the ego that Joy was touching on is what you mentioned with there is a fear or kind of a stigma with asking for help. And yeah. I started thinking about that a lot, you know, as I read that, and a few times that comes up in the book. And I was trying to decide if that's kind of like a uniquely American thing or if that's just something that seems to come par with the course for horse owners, because it does seem like, you know, some of it is maybe ego driven. Like I had this problem sometimes with students when I used to teach, more of like they would come in and like they already knew everything about horses, and I was like, oh, amazing, like so do I also know everything about horses, this will be fun, which neither of us know anything about horses actually, but the flip side of that is also like I don't want to ask for any help because yeah. it's shameful, you know, to say like I can't afford this horse right now, but maybe in 6 months I could. So is there any way to kind of bridge that gap? But I can't decide if that's a horse owner thing or an American thing or some combination, or if this is also a problem in other places. Like I don't think I know everything about cars, but I own a car, so right. I don't know right. why this seems to come with horses and with horse
I culture. Would argue, Kristen, that I think that's across all industries and facets, to be honest.
Is it? Man, I don't know a thing about my car. I take that to a mechanic every time it does something.
Yes. I think that the difference is you're probably not emotionally invested in your car, right? Whereas you probably are emotionally invested in your horse. And mm-hmm. and maybe it does speak a little bit to ego, you know, if we end up with a training challenge that we feel we should, you know, for whatever reason, we feel we should be able to handle and are having issues with, whether it's a financial issue, you know, again, based on the data that the United Horse Coalition and the Equine Welfare Data Collective have pulled from some of our custodial organizations, we do know that the top three reasons that horses end up in need of help all have to do with their owners. So the owner, you know, lost their job, the owner had a health crisis or passed away unexpectedly, the owner ran into some kind of financial distress. And, you know, when those things happen, those are times of life for a human that are really difficult, right? And probably the horse isn't the only aspect of their life where things are not going well or they're having trouble. And they're probably feeling, many of them, overwhelmed cosmically, right? And now I have this other obligation, this animal that I genuinely care about. And you know, I remember when I spoke to the team at the ASPCA, you know, their research shows that some of these horse owners will wait something like 18 months before they actually begin to seek help. They will let things kind of fall to pieces. So, you know, sometimes when we find horses that are in distress, right, horses that have gotten thinner than they ought to have, that have missed some farrier appointments, maybe they didn't get their annual vaccines done, they haven't had a dental, like we see these kinds of, you know, the start of neglect, we often find that we have humans who are suffering as well. And you know, it for me, as I learned more about that, and as I spoke to people who worked in that space, it kind of broke my heart to know that, you know, we can be very quick. Let's be honest. We can be very quick to condemn someone whose mm-hmm. horse doesn't look good, right? But do we stop and ask what is going on with this human? How can we help in a way that is compassionate, that is empathetic, that is truly offering help without judgment? Right, to help both the horse and the human. And that piece, I think, it was very eye-opening for me, because I'm sure I've been one of those people who have maybe been judgmental when I could have been more compassionate.
Yeah, I remember that from the Horse Nation days, you know, covering some of these stories of like, you know, large scale, like farm seizures where entire herds of horses, you know, and people are just reaming owners out in the comments. And you're like, yes, okay, there was a hoarding situation here. Something has gone tragically awry, but like, this is a sign of a person who needed help and
right.
didn't get it for whatever reason, whether they didn't ask for it or like no one, they just didn't have that support network. So, and that is, it's hard to do, right? Because horses are such an emotional thing for all of us, you know, to be like, well, now let's think of the person, right? Like nobody wants to do that. I get it. But,
right,
but
right.
that is, yeah, the horses are a symptom of a bigger problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which no one can tackle in a single book. So that's,
You know, and I think sometimes too, just to kind of build on that idea that there is help available, but people don't always know where to go or how to get it or how to access it.
No, it's hard to navigate.
And so that's something, you know, I hoped to share in this book, and I hope readers will take away. Maybe I'm a horse lover. Maybe I'm not a horse owner, but I give, you know, I do charitable giving every year. Maybe one of my recipients is a safety net organization that offers some sort of short-term financial assistance to a horse owner in financial distress to offset some of those costs. If what's going on is a short-term financial crisis and we can get them through that hump, and then that horse gets to stay in his loving home.
Right. I love that. I want to circle back one more question about thoroughbred aftercare, because of course that is near and dear to our hearts. So there, you know, and increasingly in the thoroughbred aftercare space, we are seeing more and more farms, like large breeding farms, as well as like small scale, small time breeders and owners are developing in-house aftercare programs. So right. Like, I know like Stacey Clark mentioned it kind of in passing in the book, or I think maybe you mentioned it, you know, as part of her bio that she helped set one up at Edina Springs. Yes. I think a really, really well-known one right now is Godolphin Lifetime Care. Godolphin is probably the biggest owner in the world. You know, they have facilities on multiple continents, and they have this wonderful in-house program where any horse that they've bred or owned, has basically a home or a safety net for life. And they don't do probably as much as they could to promote that. And I think as an industry, we need to do more to promote that, because I think that speaks exactly to the theme that kind of kept coming back in your book, was like the industry, the equine industry needs to find its own solutions. And yeah. I think programs like that help bring it out of entirely a charitable endeavor, because, you know, you touched earlier on, like, here are the reasons why it's good to have it be, you know, kind of a charitable endeavor. Like, we will know how many stalls we have, like what the capacity is. But on the flip side, I think there's some peril in making it all charitable as well, because it does make it seem that like, oh, to clean up after an industry that can't take care of itself, we need to turn to charity. And then of course, charity is always, I mean, I work for a nonprofit, like at least 50% of our time where we'd rather be doing the actual work, we're working on fundraising, because that's what we need to do just to keep the lights on. So I think there's also a danger in posing charitable solutions as like the number one best chance here to fix this problem. So I am curious, because I think there's enough scope, you know, I'm a little biased, but I think there's enough scope here if you wanted to, and maybe you don't after this much research, but I think you could write an entire book on thoroughbred aftercare and its approach to this challenge. So absolutely. I'm just curious if you've came across any more of these in-house programs, you know, that aren't charity, but are very much the industry kind of taking care of its own.
You know, there are definitely several in the thoroughbred industry that are notable. There are also breeders that have that mentality, right? Individual breeders and other breeds in other organizations, right? Where they will always take back one of their homebreds. You know, it's interesting, because I guess, as I said, my initial thought was, okay, if not slaughter, then what? Mm-hmm. The hope would be that in the long term, as an industry, if we can embrace a bit of a mindset shift, and starting with breeding more thoughtfully, starting with getting horses into good training programs, starting with making more appropriate choices for each horse across his life cycle, starting with thinking of different and more creative ways to, I'm going to use the word repurpose, but, you know, finding niches for horses that maybe otherwise don't have a lot of great options. My hope would be that in time we reduce the number of horses that end up without a good spot. You know, mm-hmm. There's always going to be some percentage that need a true rescue organization, someone who can step in and intervene. But my hope is, with a mindset shift of, you know, as you're aging, as you know, if I'm a private owner and my horse is approaching his 20s, maybe I've been doing something like setting aside $200 every month since the day I purchased that horse at age 10. And now I have a little nest egg to help carry him through his retirement years. Mm-hmm. Right? It's making it an expectation that as a horse ages or as a horse transitions, at some point, you have to accept the responsibility for that animal to see him through to the end of life. And it's about normalizing conversations around euthanasia, which I talk about at several points during the book, where there are some horses where euthanasia is not the worst thing that can happen to a horse whose life path, you know, whatever's going on with him, maybe he has a chronic health condition, maybe it can be managed, but maybe it's quite expensive to manage. It is okay. We need to normalize the conversation that euthanasia is a viable, humane, fair way to handle that horse's, you know, last days and letting them go on a good day in a peaceful way, rather than passing that horse on at an auction and hoping someone else will pick them up and maybe they'll do a better job than I can do. Right. Mm-hmm. So my fervent hope really is that with a mindset change, with all of these little different pieces of the puzzle, we can reduce the number of horses that find themselves in these dire circumstances. And, you know, part of it is programs that have the resources, you know, like the ones we were just talking about within the thoroughbred industry, to take back their animals and offer them that care. You know, realistically, not everyone can do that for every horse they've ever touched in their lives. But I do think there has to come a point where, particularly as you own an older horse, you need to say, okay, I need to realistically think about what is going to happen. What is my plan for this animal when he gets to a stage where he can no longer do the job I want him to do, and there's nowhere else to step him down to?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think again, huge topic. And I think you handled it tactfully and eloquently. You know, Joy and I both read it. Like, I found it's not the easiest subject to read about, but you presented it in a way that is easy to read and engaging to read. So we'll do a quick plug. It is Unwanted, The Causes and Effects of America's Horse Population Crisis. It's published through Trafalgar Square, correct? That's where.
Yes.
Yep. All right. So that would be the number one place to purchase all of your horse books, but definitely Unwanted by Christina Keim. Joy, closing thoughts. You read the book. You liked it.
I read it. It definitely made me think, which honestly, I needed that. It was good. So I would recommend it for sure.
Yeah. Christina, thank you so much. I think we could talk. I mean, we could dive deeper into this subject for hours and hours and hours. But I think we've hit all the high notes we wanted to touch on with Thoroughbred Aftercare. And yeah, if you get inspired to write that Thoroughbred Aftercare book, hit us up, because we'd love to help you out. Christina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Cashel has been crafting top-notch products since 1986, designed to make your ride safer, more convenient, and downright enjoyable. From the Crusader Fly Mask, the ultimate fly mask, trusted by riders nationwide, to the Blanket Top Performance Felt Pad with pressed felt with merino fleece, it's like a spa day for your horse's back, to the beautiful beaded halters, adjustable, durable, and gorgeous. Visit CashelCompany.com today and gear up for the ride of a lifetime. Cashel, where quality meets the saddle.
For first-time horse owners and new riders just starting out, finding the information and support you need can be challenging. That's why Equine Network has partnered with Sentinel Feed to bring you My New Horse, a place where equestrians just getting into horse ownership or riding will find the resources and community they need at precisely their stage of the equine journey. From important horsekeeping information and how-to videos to social media communities and more, My New Horse is your one-stop shop for riders of all levels and disciplines who are eager to find easy-to-understand horse care information and guidance. Start your horse ownership journey today. Visit mynewhorse.com.
Well, it was that time of the show where we bring on new vocations to share an adoptable horse and a training tip. And today we're joined by Erin McDonald, who is at the Ocala location, so in Florida, if you're close by there. Welcome back to the show, Erin.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me. Always enjoy being on the podcast.
It's always fun having you. And I love hitting like the more satellite sites too, because it just showcases how available the horses actually are across the country. So it is nice to be able to touch base in somewhere that isn't Lexington. Although we love our Lexington friends too. Before we dive into our adoptive horse, who is in a way like a little mini celebrity, it's kind of, he's like a B-list celebrity, very excited for it. I know Kristen had a training question to pose to you.
I do. So I'm excited for your take on this, Erin. I think when we're training horses, I think, like, obviously there's plenty of ways to mess this process up, right? But I think people tend to fall into one of two camps. They either, like, maybe push a horse a little too fast, which can be problematic. And then there's another camp of us that maybe hold a horse back a little too long because we're afraid to push a horse too fast. And then sometimes those horses are actually trying to ask us for more work. So when you're dealing with a horse that maybe, you know, is a little bit on the bored side, how do you tell if a horse is, like, asking for more work and is finding creative ways to express that versus a horse that's actually a little maybe stressed or is being pushed too hard or is sore somewhere?
Yeah. So I think, like, the biggest difference between those two situations would be that typically a horse that's communicating that maybe they're struggling or sore, there's maybe a pain response there, you're always going to find that there's a level of anxiety. And when you go to ask them to do their job and take a step further in their training, there's always going to be, it's met with kind of this angst, where a horse that typically is maybe getting a little bit bored in their training, it's going to be maybe a little bit more playful feeling. It's something where they're trying to, like, actively keep themselves kind of engaged in a different way. Where when you have that kind of level of almost worry in your partner, that's typically where we need to kind of do a bit more of a deep dive in figuring out sort of what's going on.
I think that is, like, the probably simplest, but also, like, most encouraging take on that I think I've ever heard. Like, my horse in the spring is very prone to, like, some shenanigans, and every spring I'm like, oh, is it because you're sore? And there is no angst. Yeah. There is only confidence and swagger, which is now reinforcing to me that, yeah, he's maybe a little bored after winter off and wants to kick up his heels, and I feel like we're all gonna die. So so I'm like, no, there's no running going on here. But yeah, that the lack of angst, I think that's so key. And it's, like, such a nice, simple way to put it, but, like, really sums it up well. So I love that.
I mean, honestly, I think, like, in training horses, like, let's try to keep it as simple as we can, you know, like, we can complicate things, overcomplicate things. And I think just, like, taking a step back and just trying to look at it in just, like, a very simple scope. I think that's something that would feel, you know, there's obviously always going to be factors, but I feel that that feels like a pretty straightforward way to look at it.
Yeah, for sure. I'm like a, like, grade A overcomplicator. I don't know. Joy, how are you? Joy is probably a little, like, simpler approach than I am, but I like that response. I'm going to record that and keep it in my head next time.
I honestly think I take a similar approach to Erin of, like, what does the energy feel like? Like, if it is more anxious, combative, or, you know, just kind of seems more high strung. And I tend to lean towards, like, let's check, like, is this a saddle fit bit issue? Like, how are our feet? Like, I like to just do that, like, health review first. And then if it's more of the horse seems to be owning more of the ride than the rider is, I look at it as it's time to upskill. Like, this horse needs a little more on its plate. So we set back, but that's my personal thoughts on how I try to read it.
Nice. I like it. All right, cool. Well, that is, like, a much, I like that simple approach. Love that. Perfect, Erin. All right. Well, Erin, let's talk about our very cool adoptable horse who we don't have direct access to him because I know you guys are, like, listing him, like, today. So we are just ahead of the curve here. But because we know who he is, we have his race record pulled up. He's a pretty cool guy. Tell us about Perform.
Yeah, so he has been with us for a little bit. We finished up his rehab for just a minor tendon injury that he arrived with. Nothing super exciting there, very uncomplicated. So we finished that up. We've just been getting him assessed under saddle, assessing him on the ground, kind of in his daily life, living with him. And he is a very cool dude. He's got an incredible work ethic. He very much, I think, is going to want a partner that is competitive as he is. So it's kind of fun to place those horses, especially in a second career show home. So he is one that's going to be, I think, a really great fit for perhaps, I feel like, a nice event horse. He's super bold. I feel like he's always looking back at us, like, are you coming? So I think that's kind of a fun personality, maybe for a more experienced adopter. But yeah, like he's a cool guy. He tries hard. He's actually a little bit more of like, kind of like a quarter horsey type, which are typically a stamp of the good magics. He's his sire. So yeah, like he's been a lot of fun to work with. He's, like I said, he's just like a little bit of an interesting personality. I think he's just going to be really cool to see excel at his second career.
Well, now my ears are up because you said quarter horse type. So I can't wait to see the pictures of him, which I know you guys are going to love him soon. All right, maybe I need to take a road trip to Ocala. So
there you go.
Now, do you find, so this guy is, he is a stakes horse. He is a stakes winner. And he also ran in the Preakness, which I think is very cool. Do you guys find that these stakes horses have like a little different sort of like atmosphere about them or a different personality?
Yeah, I feel like those horses honestly have kind of the star quality about them. Like they have kind of that sparkle. They work hard and they've been successful for a reason. So I think that translates really well to a second career. And it's fun to watch them kind of figure out their new jobs and then take life by the horns and kind of like get on with it. I feel like they're a ton of fun to work with. We get quite a few, maybe not the level that he was at, but he, yeah, they're a blast to work with. I think they need just as serious of a competitor as they are, like I said. So a lot of fun. He'll be a cool horse for someone to produce.
Yeah, this is neat. And if you had any doubts of like, oh, I don't know if this horse has been exposed to enough stuff. So not only did he, you know, run in the Preakness. So with all the pomp and circumstance and TV cameras and crowds associated with the Preakness, but he also went through the Keeneland September sale as a yearling and brought $230,000. So that's not like fooling around money. Like that's, that's a pretty classy yearling, which meant that he did the whole Keeneland thing, which if you've ever been to Keeneland on a sales week is just also a different brand of chaos. So this horse has clearly been exposed to a lot and is ready for whatever a second career will throw at him.
Yeah, not much is going to faze him. And that's the little piece of him that have definitely seen is that he just kind of marches around, doesn't care about the jumps in our ring, banners, nothing. Like the atmosphere that this horse has already been exposed to, a little horse show isn't going to be, you know, much sweat off his back kind of thing. So yeah, it's going to be a fun horse.
Yeah, cool guy. All right.
I was going to ask Aaron, is that the type of horse that someone who's thinking about doing the makeover in 2026 would want to keep an eye out for?
Absolutely. Yep. Because a horse like that is going to show up in Lexington and he's going to be really glad that this was built for him.
Well, it's you heard me. It here first, everyone. If you're thinking about the makeover, this could be a nice one to have on your lot. Just get to know them for the next couple months and start putting that training work in them starting in January.
Love that. Well, Aaron, remind people what they need to do if they want a horse from New Vocations.
Yeah. So visit us online. Everything is going to be online, all of our steps under the adopt tab on our website. So follow that. There's a questionnaire to fill out and then you're going to submit an adoption application. Once that's approved, you can reach out to the trainer on a specific horse, or I love when our adopters reach out just with kind of their wish list. And then if we have horses like Perform here that maybe isn't available yet and he's a good fit for, you can always get a bit of a sneak peek on those horses. Yeah. And then once we have a conversation and it's a good fit, then you get to welcome your new horse home.
Lovely. Love it. All right. Thanks very much, Aaron. Newvocations.org or horseadoption.com. You can find our show notes and links to today's guests on the website at horseradionetwork.com. Like us on Facebook and Instagram. Just search for Retired Racehorse Radio. Follow the network on Twitter at Horse Radio. You can find me on Instagram and Threads at The Horseback Writer. My email is kristen@horseradionetwork.com.
You can find me on Instagram at MisfitMare, and my email is joy@horseradionetwork.com. Thank you so much to our sponsors, Kentucky Performance Products, Cashel Company, and My New Horse, and to our partners, New Vocations Racehorse Adoption Program and the Retired Racehorse Project. Don't forget to check out all the other shows on the Horse Radio Network, part of Equine Network at horseradionetwork.com. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show as it really helps us grow. Remember to set your goals high and love to learn from every ride.
And as always, cow side leg.
Bye, guys.